All ideologies, at every stage in their careers, distort reality in some degree. But in its youth and prime, a major ideology remains closely enough in touch with the social world from which it has sprung to permit it to inspire and guide effective and sometimes creative action. This was the case with the older liberalism of the 19th century and the early years of our own. But the liberal ideology has by now got so far out of touch with fact that through its lens it has become impossible to see reality, much less to act positively on reality. Most of the categories of modern liberalism no longer correspond to anything in the world of space and time. They are mythical creatures on an Olympus much further out in empty space than the residents of the ancient gods, who never lost their habit of frequently touching down on Earth. The liberal flight from reality is headlong on every front. It could not have a purer or sillier symbol than the multiplication in this country of rules that prohibit the designation of race or color on many sorts of license, document, record, and statistic, a classic instance of the attempt to substitute a satisfying self-generated dream world for a distasteful reality. It is just as silly, of course, to discuss peace with communists, to expect civilized statesmanship from tribal chiefs, or to imagine you can stop the clock of a scientific technology by signing test ban agreements. What are the crucial present challenges to Western civilization? There are 100 challenges, certainly large and small, but let us narrow down to the challenges that clearly and immediately and powerfully threaten actual survival. These do not include, contrary to ritual liberal insistence, mere hunger and poverty. Hunger and poverty are nothing novel and nothing special. In themselves, they pose no peculiar problems that haven't been posed 1,000 times before. The poor, we were told by a source that the pre-liberal West was once prepared to believe, we have always with us. The crucial present challenges are, I believe, three. First, the jungle now spreading within our own society, in particular in our great cities. Second, the explosive population growth and political activization within the world's backward areas, principally the equatorial and sub-equatorial latitudes, occupied by non-white masses. Third, the drive of the communist enterprise for a monopoly of world power. Looking through the glass of liberalism, it is impossible, I repeat, even to see these challenges clearly. And liberalism apart, it cannot be easy for people like the author and most readers of this book, who lead, whether aware of it or not, lives carefully sheltered from social horrors, to comprehend the reality of our domestic jungles. Strained headlines thrust it on our attention, but the mechanical repetitions of sensationalist journalism have come to seem almost as meaningless as a TV serial. Now and then I get a front-line report from some unknown correspondent who has happened to read something I have written, like one who wrote from Philadelphia not long after the 1960 election campaign. In Philadelphia, city of brotherly love, the jungle is called just that, the jungle. The Kennedys and the Nixons and the other out-of-touch young men believe that we must go on civil-righting our civilization to death. But they don't know what is happening to the people. I am referring to the little people who ride the buses and streetcars and subways, the little people who put up with muggings, rapings, beatings, stabbings and murderings. The little people, who, when the criminals are caught, are told that as culturally handicapped victims of society, the criminals had every justification for committing their crimes. As a man who lives among, and is one of these little people, I can aver that the common topic of discussion, just as surely as the sun rises and sets every day, at lodge meetings and sports gatherings and family get-togethers, is the increasing savagery of the savages among us. Almost always someone present has been a victim of a savage attack, or has a relative or neighbor who has been a victim. Last week I heard one cynical neighbor say, "We're in more danger than the pioneers ever were. When night fell, they closed the gates of the stockade. They knew the savages were outside. Nowadays, when night falls, We know we've got them roaming around inside with us. What's worse, they're armed, and we're not. And worst of all, one of them is caught attacking a woman, and a civil liberties lawyer gets him off. The woman victim is maligned by the lawyer as being little better than a prostitute, while the arresting cop is lucky if he gets off without losing his job. A woman named Marjorie K. McGoldrick, who might have been any of a million others, wrote the New York Herald Tribune, October 20, 1962, about the nation's largest and the world's richest city, as she was acquainted with it. Recently, our police commissioner, Michael J. Murphy, went on record with the statement that there is no reign of terror in New York. Anyone who has eyes which are even drowsily opened for 1/20th of an inch knows that there is no tranquility in most parts of this city. Take, for example, the recent experiences of the occupants of a 5-story building containing 6 apartments on Riverside Drive between 79th and 80th Streets. 1. A man from the first floor was coming home around 1 a.m. and was mugged at the outside entrance door. 2. On the fourth floor, a girl and her friend were sitting in the living room one evening when they were suddenly surprised by an intruder who threatened their lives if they didn't cover their heads and toss out their wallets. 3. A girl on the fifth floor came home one evening to find her apartment burglarized and a number of valuable things missing. 4. Another evening, the police were looking for a man on the roof, and later it was found that several windows in the building had been entered, including those of the same fourth and fifth floor apartments aforementioned, with many things stolen from the fourth floor. 5. Several days ago, the 2 apartments on the fifth floor were entered, one of them for the third time, and a number of things were taken, with locks jammed and other locks completely broken. Also, 2 girls in a building nearby were raped recently, and in another building, burglaries occur about once a week. Do the enumerated occurrences not constitute a reign of terror? Or just what kind of pretty term can be substituted? Each time something happened, police came, and each time the attitude was one of helplessness and resignation. That this is something which happens every day, is to be expected, and that there is not much to be done about it. Time, March 22, 1963, began a description of the condition of the capital city of the leading nation of Western civilization. Muggers attack in broad daylight. Churches lock their doors because, as one clergyman explains, too many bums come in, wander around, and take what they like. Last week a purse snatcher was shot to death by a rookie policeman. A 40-year-old man was beaten to death in his home with a leg wrenched by a couple of intruders from his end table. A bank was robbed, and police pursued the bandits through the streets while passers-by scattered to escape the gunfire. History has a remarkable way of providing striking visual symbols of what is really going on that tell us much more than the pretentious statistics of the sociologists. In the parks of our great cities, exactly as in all jungles, honest men may no longer move at night. When the sun goes down, they must stay near the fires while the beasts prowl. In those dark jungles and along the jungle paths into which the night transforms so many city streets, huge dogs now join the few hunters still on trail. What have dogs, killer dogs, moreover, to do with men? But dogs are, of course, appropriate companions in hunting the beasts of the jungle. For the liberal ideology, the domestic jungles are the merely temporary byproducts of a lack of education and faulty social institutions, to be cleared up by urban renewal programs, low rents, high minimum wages, and integrated schools, in which regulations forbid physical discipline, expulsion, or failing to certify every student to the next higher grade each year. The backward regions of the equatorial zones are only for liberalism, enlarged slums that will be put to rights by the standard remedies, education, democracy, and welfare in the special form of foreign aid. It is impossible for liberalism or liberals to face a truth that is perhaps too terrible for any secular ideology to face, that with only minor exceptions, there is no chance whatever to cure the hunger, poverty, and wretchedness of these 2 billion human beings in the foreseeable future, that these conditions will, on average, much more probably worsen than improve, even in small measure. Liberalism cannot either see or deal with the domestic jungle and the backward regions. The two challenges are closely similar. Liberalism is unfitted by its rationalistic optimism, its permissiveness, its egalitarianism and democratism, and by its guilt. Consider once more the logic of liberalism in relation to the backward regions, bringing it to bear on the question of survival. From the universalism and democratism of the liberal ideology, there follows, as we saw, the familiar one-man, one-vote principle of which so much has lately been made. The United States Supreme Court explicitly affirmed it in its March 18, 1963 decision on the Georgia voting case. This principle implies, by simple arithmetic, the subjugation of the West. The members of Western civilization are a small minority. It is as simple as that. The economic egalitarianism of the liberal ideology implies, as we also saw, the reduction of Westerners to hunger and poverty. Of course, liberals hide these implications from themselves and from Western public opinion. They dream up some sort of world democracy in which a reasonable world society uses the one-man, one-vote principle to achieve universal freedom, peace and justice, and economic egalitarianism means plenty for all. But that is ideological fantasy. It is the subjugation or disappearance of the West and Western, indeed universal, hunger and poverty that are the unavoidable end terms of the logic of liberalism. Naturally, this logic is not carried out, or has not yet been carried out all the way in practice. But in the soul of liberalism, and in the Western civilization that liberalism has permeated, this logic works like a spiritual worm, corrupting the will of the West to survive as a distinctive historical entity, easing the dissolution of the West into the distinctionless human mass. It could not be otherwise. In this case, the liberal knows he is guilty, and his guilt is not a mere subjective sentiment. It is a fact that the liberals of the affluent society, by not yielding their power and privileges, more fully and more quickly are guilty, guilty precisely of betraying their own principles. There is only one way to escape the conclusions from these logical deductions, by rejecting at least some of the principles from which the deductions start. There would have to be a rejection, in particular, of the quantitative reduction of human beings to common man, and a reassertion of qualitative distinctions. Quite specifically, there would have to be reasserted the pre-liberal conviction that Western civilization, thus Western man, is both different from and superior in quality to other civilizations and non-civilizations, from whatever source that difference and superiority are derived or acquired. And there would have to be a renewed willingness, legitimized by that conviction, to use superior power and the threat of power to defend the West against all challenges and challengers. Unless Western civilization is superior to other civilizations and societies, it is not worth defending. Unless Westerners are willing to use their power, the West cannot be defended. But by its own principles, liberalism is not allowed to entertain that conviction or to make frank, unashamed, and therefore effective use of that power. What does liberalism do about these terrible, soul-shattering losses, defeats, and withdrawals, and the still more searing defeats suffered by the West at the hands of the communist enterprise? Liberalism does not and cannot stop them, much less win back what has been lost. Indeed, in many instances, it has rather helped them along. But what liberalism can and does do, what it is marvelously and specifically equipped to do, is to comfort us in our afflictions, and then, by a wondrous alchemy, to transmute the dark defeats, withdrawals, and catastrophes into their bright opposites, into gains, victories, advances. distilled in the liberal alembic, the geographic, political, demographic, and strategic losses emerge as triumphs of freedom, equality, progress, and virtue. The troops of a fanatic Arab imperialist armed by the communist enterprise stand at the Suez Bridge in place of the men of Britain and France? Do not be troubled, fellow Westerners. Reactionary imperialism has suffered a deserved setback. Self-determination, the equality of races, and the rights of small nations have been upheld. A blow has been struck at aggression. The sanctity of one universal law for all mankind has been vindicated. I repeat what I stated in the first chapter. I do not suggest that liberalism is the cause of the contraction and possible, on the evidence probable, death of Western civilization. I do not know what the cause is of the West's extraordinarily rapid decline, which is most profoundly shown by the deepening loss among the leaders of the West of confidence in themselves and in the unique quality and value of their own civilization, and by a correlated weakening of the Western will to survive. The cause or causes have something to do, I think, with the decay of religion and with an excess of material luxury, and, I suppose, with getting tired, worn out, as all things temporal do. But though liberalism did not initiate the decline and cannot be blamed for it, the influence of liberalism on public opinion and governmental policy has become, by obscuring the realities, corrupting will, and confounding action, a major obstacle to a change of course that might have some chance of meeting the challenges and of arresting and reversing the decline. Primarily, however, the ideology of modern liberalism must be understood as itself one of the expressions of the Western contraction and decline, a kind of epiphenomenon or haze accompanying the march of history, a swan song, a spiritual solace of the same order as the murmuring of a mother to a child who is gravely ill. There is a really dazzling ingenuity in the liberal explanations of defeat as victory, abandonment as loyalty, timidity as courage, withdrawal as advance. The liberal ideologues proceed in a manner long familiar to both religion and psychology, by constructing a new reality of their own, a transcendental world where the soul may take refuge from the prosaic, unpleasant world of space and time. In that new and better world, the abandonment of a million of one's own countrymen and the capitulation to a band of ferocious terrorists become transformed into what is called liberation. The loss of control over the strategic axis of the great continent becomes a vindication of universal law. A crude imperialist grab in the South Seas or the Indian subcontinent becomes a clearing up of the vestiges of colonialism. The failure to retaliate against gross insults and injuries to envoys, citizens, and property becomes a proof of maturity and political wisdom.